on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM,
where you're listening to The Space Show. Matthias Maurer is a European Space Agency astronaut who's due to go up to the space station late this month. He spoke a few days ago about tourists on the International Space Station and also about the problem of space pollution.
During my mission, it will be the Expedition 66, so the 66th team that is flying to the ISS. There will be a lot of innovation. And so we will see the very first space tourist while we are up there in space. The Russian film team that you mentioned will actually fly already early October. I will arrive at the end of October. So I will miss the Russian film team. Tomas Pesquet will welcome them, and maybe he also has a chance to act in the movie, in the Russian one. However, at the beginning of December, when I'm already on board of the station, there will be another capsule arriving, a Soyuz capsule, with two Japanese space tourists. And one of these two tourists is actually also the person who bought the first flight in a commercial capsule around the moon with SpaceX. So a curious person that I'm looking forward to meet in space. At the beginning of February, I believe, will be the arrival of an American capsule from SpaceX. And there will be three space tourists and one commander. The commander is an experienced astronaut who has been various times on the International Space Station. And these three billionaire tourists are from Canada, from Israel, and from the United States. So we see already three flights in the next 6 months that bring billionaires and tourists to the International Space Station. I think that's only the beginning. And if you ask me what my opinion is on that one, I think it's good to see more people in space because all these people have the same dream that I have. They want to see our planet from the outside. They all want to experience how it is to be in space, to be in weightlessness. And having more people flying to space means like we need to have better and more robust technology. So that will also bring a benefit for all the space agencies to fly scientists like me to space so that it gets cheaper and more resilient and more robust. On the other hand, having more people flying to space also causes more garbage in space. And we need to make sure that we don't pollute our space because we have a lot of old satellites already in space, and we need to clean up space, to take care of space. I don't want to see space being as polluted as today, our oceans, because we don't care about it and because we think it's so big, nobody will see that there's lots of waste and garbage flying up there.
Josef Aschbacher is the Director General of the European Space Agency. He has these thoughts about space tourism.
This is certainly something that I see growing. I think this is a segment that we completely underestimate today. In a couple of years, maybe in 5, maybe in 10 years, I would expect that there are more tourists flying to space than astronauts in a classical sense that do experiments and missions. And that may certainly give a huge boost to human spaceflight. Think back to the early days of airplanes. The very first pilots on airplanes were, I would say, pioneers, the very few of them, and it was not widely used. After tourism started, all the airlines and their airplane industry was booming and was almost exploding. I'm not saying that we see the same frequency of flights into space as we see now on the airspace, but for me, this is certainly a very important step that tourism, space tourism, will drastically change the way we fly to space. I see it coming. It's not happening tomorrow, but it will come in the future. And I think, and I fully agree with what Matthias was saying, it's great to see it happening. And we should be all very excited. And I hope that we find opportunities in Europe to actively participate in this activity. On the other side, we have to do it responsibly. And this is, I think, a strength of Europe, that we always look at our environment on Earth, but also in space. And I'm very excited to work on plans and dreams to make this happen.
Meanwhile, the European Space Agency recently announced it was recruiting full-time professional astronauts. And, well, there are lots of applications.
3, 2, 1, 0. Mission?
Who wouldn't want to be an astronaut? Launching in a rocket, floating in microgravity, viewing the Earth from the unique perspective of space. Little wonder more than 22,500 people from across 22 ESA member states and 3 associate member states have applied for this opportunity. ESA is also investigating the opportunities for astronauts with physical disabilities. 257 candidates have applied for this new programme. Selected astronauts could be among the first humans in 50 years to go beyond low Earth orbit.
Our goal is to have by 2030 a first European walking on the moon. Now, this might not be one of the new class astronauts, it might still be one of the older class of 2009, but we are not just aiming for one mission to the moon, we are aiming for a sustainable lunar exploration program. So I'm sure that some of those young people that will join the astronaut corps now will have the opportunity one day to walk on the moon.
But the selection process is going to be tough. Those who get through the initial screening will undergo medical, psychological, and psychometric tests before a 2-stage interview process, culminating in an interview with the ESA Director General. To ensure a fair and thorough process, this will all take at least 18 months.
It's a long process, and there's going to be gaps in between each selection phase while the results are analysed, and which candidates are taken forward to the next phase. So yes, I would say that people need a good dose of patience in this process.
Spaceflight has changed a lot since the first astronauts were chosen more than 60 years ago. They still need to be academically qualified and have a good level of physical fitness, but today it's not so much the right stuff as the right attitude.
They have to be good team players, they have to be able to get along with people. You can imagine up in space in close confinement with others for several months at a time. They have to have good conflict resolution skills, be able to tackle conflicts before they really become a conflict and get along well with people. It's very important.
Astronauts spend most of their time on Earth, supporting missions, studying and training for their next assignment, or taking part in outreach programs. Once on a mission, most of the time is spent on experiments, equipment maintenance and exercise. There's not much time to stare out of the window. In 2022, Samantha Cristoforetti will take command of the International Space Station. At the moment, she's the only active female ESA astronaut. But in this latest recruitment round, more women have applied than ever before. Not many will ever get to experience this view. But for the thousands of applicants who don't make it, there are plenty more opportunities in space.
We have a lot of very interesting jobs in other domains coming up in the coming years, so keep an eye on our careers at ESA website. And if you don't make it to become an astronaut, apply for something else.
Unfortunately, Australia is not part of the European Space Agency, so those applications aren't open to you. Yesterday, Blue Origin announced that actor William Shatner and the company's president of mission and flight operations, Audrey Powers, will fly on New Shepard 18. As stated in last week's The Space Show, the United States company had earlier announced the Australian Chris Boshausen and US citizen Glenn DeVries will also be aboard. Now, correcting last week's program, the launch will be next Wednesday at 12:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Now, last week I gave an incorrect day based on late information from a usually reliable source that unfortunately turned out to be wrong. So once again, next Wednesday at 12:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, and we will have our third Australian astronaut in space. But he's not he's not a professional astronaut. The New Shepard 18 flight will be a suborbital one to over 100 kilometres altitude and lasting a little over 10 minutes. The capsule will parachute to a landing not far from the launch pad. Now, William Shatner is the character that introduces and punctuates our space show Planet Earth series. At age 90, he will become the oldest person to go into space. Audrey Powers is a former flight controller with 2,000 hours of console time in Houston, Mission Control, for the International Space Station. Well, here's a recording of Boshausen speaking while he was still working at the Ames Research Center quite a few years ago.
So I want to talk about why somebody might want to get something into space and how to do that. And there's a couple of different ways to do that. And what I want to leave all of you with is my belief that all of you, if you wanted to, could do anything you want. And if that included building spaceships and sending them to the moon, you could do that. And so not only that, I'm going to back that up with some evidence and show you how you can do that. So if you have an interest in getting to space, getting something to space, or ultimately one day getting yourself there and your friends, I'll show you how. So where's the clicker, by the way? Here it is. Okay, left or right, that's always the question. So this is a photograph. It's a really amazing photograph. There's three little white blobs here. One's the moon. The one on the bottom that looks like an airplane is a kind of airplane. It's a carrier airplane for carrying a small spaceship. And the top one at the top is that small spaceship. This photograph was taken in 2004 when this tiny little thing was the first private vehicle to ever get into space. So this is actually was a this moment changed my life. I actually flew to the Mojave Desert to see this. So before that day, space was something governments did. And it was expensive, extremely expensive, and it was extremely complicated. If you went and asked any company that builds things for the federal government, builds space vehicles for the federal government, they'll tell you, oh, it's really expensive. And you ask why, and they say, oh, because it's so expensive. What this spaceship did, for about $60 million, got a private citizen to space. It was funded by Paul Allen from Microsoft. The spacecraft was built by a small company in the Mojave called Scaled Composites. And since then, Richard Branson was so inspired, he's ordered a fleet of, I think, five or six of them. They're going to have 12 seats each that can take people to space for $200,000. So something really important happened that day. Space stopped being the domain of governments and became the domain of ordinary citizens. So that was really important. But it was expensive. Okay, it was still $60 million. I don't know how many of you have $60 million in your pocket to spare. I don't. I'd like to do this, and you know, maybe I could convince Paul Allen to pay for it, or maybe there's a cheaper way to do it. So what I have been asking myself since then, really, is how cheap can you go? So I was trying to think, how do you do that, and how do you build a spacecraft that's cheap? And I was thinking about this saying, you know, space is expensive because it's expensive, and I started thinking about why was it expensive? And really it's expensive because when you send something to space, you only have one shot. And so you want to make sure that it works. And so you spend a long time planning. Sometimes in the case of, there was a spacecraft called Gravity Probe B, they spent 40 years on engineering for that thing. Now, I'm sure it was a complicated science instrument, but it took 40 years to build a spacecraft. So you get it to space, and well, after 40 years and all that money, it better damn well work. But I thought, well, what if you didn't spend all that time, and you didn't spend all that money, and you sent a piece of junk to space? Would you care if it worked or not? And if it was, say, really cheap, like, you know, $5,000, maybe you wouldn't care if it broke. And because you could always send 10 more, and maybe the 10th one will work. Or if the 10th one didn't, you could send 100. And you'd still spend less money, but maybe get something that worked. And you wouldn't care if it broke. So think about Google, and what they do is really cool. I was saying this morning, I went to use a Google spreadsheet, and there was this button that said, new version. So I clicked new version, and suddenly everything changed, and I had this better version of Google Documents. It's like, oh, that's really cool. And so I want to apply that same model to spacecraft, and what that means is rapid prototyping, releasing early and releasing often, getting stuff out to people, trying it, and you know, if it doesn't work, trying again, and finally getting something that works, have people use it, get feedback, change it. So that's different than planning for 40 years. It's actually making something today and saying, can you use this? It's kind of broken, but can you use it? And they'll go, sure. I could use that. Now, can you just fix this bit? And you go, oh, I didn't think of that. Okay, I'll fix that bit. So that's how Silicon Valley kind of does things. release early, release often, rapid prototyping, just get something out on the street. So to apply that to spacecraft, you know, obviously you still have to get things to space and they still kind of have to work, but you want to do ground testing. So I was thinking, what's the right analogy for the space industry? And it's this one. This is actually the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works factory where they built the SR-71 Blackbird. And here you can see the production line. I think they go all the way off into the distance where they're building these aircraft. One of the most amazing aircraft ever built. And it was built using a Skunk Works mentality where you had basically a crack team of really eager people, pretty much the age of most of this audience, who built this aircraft and you know kept testing it and testing it until they were sure that it worked. And through basically rapid design cycles and a very focused team with not too much design work, just building it, they actually built a very fantastic airplane. So at where I work at NASA Ames Research Center, we've been looking at the Skunk Works program and trying to build our own. So we started by building this small lunar lander. It's about the same height as this table and about half the length to give you an idea of scale. It's not something a human could fit in, but it's small enough to carry maybe 50 kilograms or 100 pounds of science things to the moon. So this spacecraft we built, I'm going to tell you the number. So typically a normal NASA space mission might cost about $500 million. Let's say $300 million just for a good number. This thing cost 300,000 in parts and about $3 million in labor. It was 12 people over 1 year. So it's about $3 million. So it's already 100 times cheaper than a typical
Since making that talk, Chris has actually managed to get that money in his pocket. And as we said, he's going to be rocketing up into space next Wednesday morning. This is The Space Show.